Welcome to 2819. I'm Sandra Dimas.
And I'm Brian Rollenbacher.
And we have a brand new 2819 format where we focus on one theme and one theme only. So no more switching back and forth.
That's right. It's going to be a lot of smoother episodes now. You're going to be able to learn one topic from like kind of different areas of that topic.
For sure.
So it's going to be good. What's today's topic, by the way?
Today's topic is old earth creationism. What is it? Why is it? How is it?
Why is old earth? I want that one answered.
Yes, for sure. No, we're going to be talking about old earth creationism. It's something that some people haven't heard of, and those who have, maybe they're not too sure what exactly it means. Maybe they think it's a bad thing. So we're going to be looking at that from all different angles, a biblical angle and a scientific angle, and unpacking it for the whole episode.
So one of the segments is Everyday Apologetics, and this is actually replacing RTB 101. And we really hope you enjoy this one. It's where we're using a lot of videos and clips from visiting scholars, partner scholars, and just getting a viewpoint from other people. So today we're going to hear from theologian Ken Keithley. He's going to be sharing about the historic view of the creation days.
And in Jeff's segment, we're going to be hearing him talk with astrophysicist Hugh Ross. And they're going to discuss the scientific evidence for the long creation days.
First up is Culture Talk. Sandra is also going to be speaking with Dr. Hugh Ross, and they're going to be talking about biblical evidence for the long creation day. So getting the science and getting the biblical evidence. It's going to be great. Let's check it out.
Now it's time for Culture Talk, where we talk about culturally relevant topics that you can use to start conversations about your faith. And I'm joined today with Dr. Hugh Ross. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure, Sandra.
I am thrilled to be talking about a topic that you get a lot of questions on, and that is about the interpretation of the creation days. So what we know is that oftentimes Christians will say that the only literal interpretation of the creation days are 24-hour days, so six 24-hour days, and that's usually an obstacle for anyone who would look at the scientific record and say, I'm not going to entertain Genesis because there's no way that the earth is that young.
Well, you know, Sandra, I was a Christian for 9 years until I met someone who thought the days were 24 hours.
Interesting. Well, it's a common belief and...
Common, you know, in the U.S. I mean, in Canada, I never ran anybody who saw it that way. And yeah, I wasn't raised in a Christian home. I didn't really look at Genesis until I was 17. But right away, I realized this word day must have three distinct literal definitions, because three are used in the first page.
Yeah.
Creation day one is using the word day for the daylight hours. Creation day four is using the word day for a 24-hour period. And in Genesis 2:4, it uses the word day for the entirety of Earth's creation history. So those are three distinct definitions. Mm-hmm. Turns out if you look at a lexicon, there's a fourth one, part of the daylight hours. Mm-hmm. What I also noticed was you got an evening and a morning for creation days 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. I expected to find the same phrase for day 7. It's not there.
Yeah.
And, you know, knowing it wasn't written in English, but in Hebrew, it says, well, who knows what these words evening and morning mean? But at a minimum, it's telling us each of these days has a definite start time and an end time. And so I didn't see an evening morning phrase for day 7. I said, maybe it's because the day's not yet finished.
Yeah. So of those four interpretations of the word day, some of us might be more familiar with the six 24-hour days, but an old earth interpretation would take that fourth definition, which is a long but finite period of time, correct?
Six consecutive periods of time.
And what is the biblical evidence when we start to look at the Bible in its entirety that would point to one interpretation or the other, or one definition or the other?
Well, at age 17, I first took the Bible seriously. I said, hey, it's 66 books. Before I draw any conclusions, I need to read through all 66 books. And there's a lot of content outside of Genesis that addresses that question. You know, for example, I mentioned there's no closure on day 7. Well, if you read Psalm 95 and Hebrews 4, it explicitly states we're still in God's seventh day. And when I saw that, that was a light bulb moment for me at age 17, because something had bothered me since I was 11 years old. is the fossil record enigma. We see all these appearances of new phyla, classes, and orders before humanity, and we see none of that after humanity. And when I looked at Genesis 1, I said, this answers the fossil record enigma. Mm-hmm. For 6 days, God creates. On the seventh day, he stops creating. He ceases from his work of creation to focus on his work of redemption. And so that, to me, explained why we see all this new speciation, all these new phyla, classes, and orders of life before humanity, and we don't see any of it after humanity appears. And then to realize, too, the Bible tells us the laws of physics are fixed. Jeremiah 33, Romans 8, which basically says God has established these laws. In fact, what I love is God says, you Jews change your mind all the time, but I'm immutable. I do not change. As proof, look to the laws that govern the heavens and the earth. As they don't change, I don't change.
So there wasn't a change in physics or anything?
No change in physics. Humans changed, but the physics didn't change. And the physics didn't change, then that means that the universe and the earth must be very old. In fact, every time I run into young earth creationist scientists, they admit if there's no change in the laws of physics at the fall or at the flood of Noah or both, then the universe and the earth must be billions of years old.
So what would the age be then for earth and for the cosmos?
Well, the Bible doesn't give you an exact age for the earth or the universe. But when we look at the book of nature, and the Bible tells us that God gave us two revelations, the book of nature and the book of scripture. And the book of nature, by multiple means, tells us the earth is 4.5662 billion years old. It's very accurate. With the universe, we only have it to four places. It's 13.79 billion years old.
So it's old for sure.
It's old for sure.
Definitely much older than a young Earth perspective, which would say it's around 6 to 10,000 years old for Earth.
But a lot younger than what astronomers back in the 1930s and 40s were saying. Back then they were thinking the universe was trillions of years old. We now know it's only billions of years old.
So, you know, later on in the show, Jeff's going to be talking about kind of the scientific evidence for long creation days, but I think it's helpful to know just from a biblical perspective that it all seems to line up when we look at the creation days.
The key is we need to read all the creation texts in the Bible literally and consistently. The book of, Hebrews is not going to contradict the book of Genesis. It's all from the same Creator God.
So with Adam, when Eve is created, what does Adam say that kind of gives us a clue as to the length of time that he may have waited?
Well, notice in Genesis 2, we've got Adam going through multiple careers before God creates the woman. And God comments and sees, hey, you know, you've been working the garden, you've been engaging all these animals, giving them names, but you're lonely. And for most men, it takes more than a few seconds to feel lonely. I don't know if you've noticed that. And so this tells us there must have been a passage of time between God creating Adam and creating Eve. God puts him to sleep. He goes under anesthesia. Surgery is performed on him. He recovers from his surgery, and he wakes up and he sees Eve. And what's interesting is what you see recorded in the original Hebrew coming out of Adam's mouth, Hapa'am. It's used 21 times in the Old Testament, almost always translated at long last. So this again indicates a passage of time for creation day six. So it's not just the seventh day that the text tells us is a long period of time. The sixth day must be as well. And the grammatical structure of Genesis 1 would imply that all the days are long periods.
So I find that fascinating because when we look at the scientific record and we look at the chronology of how things developed, you know, from plants and oceans and humans, animals, does that seem to align then with what we know of the creation days and the order?
It does. I mean, just the fact that there's over 76 quadrillion tons of biodeposits in the crust of the Earth tells us life has been on planet Earth for a really long time.
I think a criticism that people might have is that to have that long creation kind of diminishes God's power, and he can do it in an instant. So why would he need so much time?
But I know you're an artist, mm-hmm. and when you're really enjoying art, you take your time because you're really enjoying what you're doing. Mm-hmm. So I just see God saying, wow, and we look at creation. It's just mind-boggling when you think about the size of the universe, all the components of the universe. And I can imagine that God was really enjoying his works of creation. For six periods he worked, mm-hmm. and now he's resting from his work. And also we need to understand, the Bible tells us God began his works of redemption before he created anything. And so everything that God was doing in terms of creation was for his ultimate goal of redeeming billions of us humans from our sin and evil.
Yeah, well, I love the analogy of just being an artist and taking your time and getting lost in that almost, in the enjoyment of creating.
Well, I come from a family of artists, and when they're working on a piece that they're really not enjoying, they go through it quickly.
Right.
When they're really working on a masterpiece, they really spend time on it.
Well, I love that. So where can people go, because this is a huge topic, where would you point them to for more on this topic?
Well, I've written two books on this topic. One is explicitly on the creation days, and it's called A Matter of Days, and it's now on the second edition.
Yeah.
And then they also can go to Navigating Genesis.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for that, Hugh. So if you would like to learn more about this topic, go to shop.reasons.org and look for A Matter of Days or for Navigating Genesis.
Is Christianity and science in conflict? I'm joined today by Dr. Ken Keithley, who is a professor of theology at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary in Wake Forest, to help answer that question. Ken,
yes.
What do evangelical and conservative Christians actually believe about the age of the earth?
Well, we have to admit that there has been, in the last few decades, or the last 30 or 40 years, significant inroads made by the young earth community. However, historically speaking, evangelicals have held to something other than the young earth view. They've held to an old earth. In fact, when one reads the fundamentals, in which the term fundamentalist comes from, not a single author argues for a young earth position. And in fact, they argue several for other positions, some even further than you and I might be comfortable. So what one finds throughout the better part of the 20th century, that fundamentalists and evangelicals held to some version of an old earth creationism, either the gap theory or a day-age theory. As a matter of fact, the most popular study Bible of the 20th century is the Scofield Study Bible. And yet, when one looks at the Scofield notes, it teaches the gap theory. And in fact, when there was a very famous debate between Harry Rimmer, who was a well-known apologist of the early part of the 20th century, and W.B. Reilly, who was the president of the World Fundamentalist Organization, they had a debate over the proper way to interpret Genesis 1. Neither one of them argued for the young earth position. One argued day-age, the other one gap theory. It isn't until 1961, with Henry Morris's and John Whitcomb's book, The Genesis Flood, that we see a move towards young earth creationism. One of the unfortunate things that is taught by many young earth advocates is that this is the evangelical position and it is the historical position, but the facts just simply don't match up to that.
Now, how would one interpret Genesis 1 then if day isn't 24 hours?
Yeah, well, there's a number of ways that we've gone about it. There are those who do understand it to be a 24-hour, a period in which God operates, but it's called the intermittent day. There are long periods of time between each one. As we know, the word day is used in a variety of ways in Genesis chapters 1 to at least three different ways. And when we take a look at the way each day of creation is presented, you know, and God does such and such, and it says, and evening and morning, day one, and then God does this and that, evening and morning, day two. Well, if you think about it for a second, evening and morning, that's not a 24-hour day. It's not even the daytime. It's nighttime, as Jack Collins has pointed out. That's the evening when God knocks off for the day, and so it's presenting God as a workman, doing his work. And so the best way, I think, to understand the days is as analogical workdays, the very instrument that is used to calculate a 24-hour day is not in existence until the fourth day. So whatever the first 3 days are, they're not being like I said, ordained or ordered by the sun and the moon, which are the instruments that order the days and the seasons. So we have ample evidence in the text itself, which was noticed not just in the last 50 years, but by the early church fathers, Augustine and others, that this is not talking about a typical 24-hour day period.
Hello, and welcome to the segment of 2819, where we get to take a little more scholarly look at some of the arguments that are out there. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Hugh Ross, and we're going to investigate some of the scientific arguments for the age of the Earth. Hugh, it's good to have you here today.
Well, thank you.
So this has been a long-running discussion, you know, at least decades worth of discussion in the Christian church of, or the church of whether the Earth is a few thousand years old, a few billion years old. Looked earlier in the show of some of the maybe the biblical evidences for it. I want to kind of probe some of the scientific evidences. And what do you see as some of the good scientific evidences that the Earth really is billions of years old?
Well, what impresses me is some of that's actually cited in Scripture, where you got David talking about the age-old hills or the ancientness of the Kidron River. And what the text is referring there is the fact that you can see evidence of erosion. You know, when David wrote that, he was in the wilderness, where you see piles of stones and talus at the bottoms of these peaks, and realizing, you know, one rock might fall every 3 or 4 days, and look at the pile of rocks at the bottom, or you see the meandering of the Kidron River. And then just looking at the biodeposits, I think this is something every lay person can recognize. There's a lot of coal in the crust of the earth, a lot of limestone, a lot of marble, oil and natural gas, and all that got deposited by previous generations of life. And you need a long history of life in order to build up all those biodeposits and realize that was part of God's generosity towards us. He waited to create human beings until there were resources from previous generations of life that would enable us to launch and sustain global civilization. I mean, there's over 76 quadrillion tons of these biodeposits in the crust of the Earth.
So, I mean, I think that's a very reasonable way to look at things, you know, that David's looking there and seeing things falling and saying, well, this is going to take this long. But there's an assumption built into that is that the processes happen at the same rate. And one of the common objections is that the flood, Noah's flood, was a catastrophic event that everything just happened a lot faster. So how would you respond to that objection when you're talking about these biodeposits or piles of rocks?
Yeah, that changing the laws or constants of physics isn't going to help. I mean, I hear young Earth creationists saying, well, maybe the light from the sun was converted with 100% efficiency into these biodeposits. There's orders of magnitude, way more biodeposits that can be explained even with 100% efficiency conversion from the sun.
So in at least part of that objection, say to get that amount of biodeposits, you need to have that length of life. In order to do that, you'd have to change the constants of physics so that the Earth received more energy. Is that, that's entailed in that objection, correct?
You would need a completely different star than the sun.
Gotcha, okay.
The sun's not shining enough light or heat. And you say, well, we can go with a hotter star, but if you go with a hotter star, that wipes out life on planet Earth.
Okay, so there are scientific objections to having just everything happen a lot faster then.
It is, and there's scientific evidence that the laws of physics have not changed,
right,
affirming what the Bible says. I mean, we're both astronomers. When you look at distant galaxies and stars, you're measuring the laws of physics as you look at that light. And those measurements tell us that the laws of physics at every look back time we care to choose are identical to the laws that we measure in the lab.
Yeah, I find that a pretty amazing thing that we can look across the universe and we find those laws, those constants of physics being essentially identical to what we see here in the lab.
Right,
so,
right.
So, okay, so you got the amount of biodeposits, just seeing some of that. What other evidences do you see as particularly compelling that the Earth is much older than just a few thousand years?
Well, for example, there's no plutonium or neptunium left in the Earth.
Okay, and we're going to have to explain why that's important, because most people never encounter those two elements anyway.
Well, they don't, for good reason. The Earth is too old.
And explain
why. All that stuff is decayed away. Both plutonium and neptunium have radiometric decay half-lives that are in the tens of millions to the millions of years. So the fact that none of this stuff is left on the crust of the Earth tells us that the Earth must be so old that all those elements have completely decayed away. And likewise, we can look at the uranium and thorium and potassium. They're still here. But these are radioisotopes with very long half-lives. And so the quantities we see in the face of the Earth are consistent with the Earth being about 4.5 billion years old. And the argon in our atmosphere. All the argon in our atmosphere comes from the radiometric decay of potassium. And just the sheer quantity of argon in the atmosphere tells us that that potassium must have been decaying for a very long period of time.
So this, there's two elements of that piece of evidence that I want to probe. One is the idea that there are not certain elements here, in some sense, could be not very interesting because, it just could have been very well that God didn't create the Earth with those sort of elements in them. Why would we assume that those elements were there and that they've just all decayed away as opposed to not being here in the first place?
Well, we see those elements being produced in real time in stars. And so, you know, stars make this stuff, especially the bigger stars. And so, and we look at the sun. The sun doesn't have those elements either, which tells us that the sun must have formed late in the history of the universe.
Okay, so the idea is we look out into the heavens, we see these elements being produced.
We see them in the universe, but we don't see them in the crust of the Earth.
And those processes naturally would have produced them earlier
would
in the history.
Would have produced them.
And the fact that they have a long enough half-life means they were here, but they've just had a chance to decay away.
Right, and the ones we do have are what we'd expect if indeed the Earth is 4.5 billion years old.
Now, one of the other common objections that comes up to that, and this goes somewhat to the laws of physics changing, but it's a little bit more catastrophic in that there was a period of time, you know, somewhere in the creation week or maybe during the flood where God accelerated the rates of decay, and that's why certain things are gone. So all the decay happened, it just happened in a very brief period of time.
Yeah.
Is there evidence for or against that?
Well, there's biblical evidence against it because the Bible says there's been no change in the laws of physics.
Fair enough. Let's stick with the science here.
And if you stick with the science, if you accelerate the radiometric decay rates by a million or a billion times, you wind up vaporizing all life on the face of the Earth. And the biblical text says that didn't happen.
Okay, so it just that's a profound point that is not intuitively obvious. So why do you end up getting so much heat just because the rates are accelerated?
Well, I'll give you one hint everybody can understand. If you were to accelerate the velocity of light by a factor of a million times, Einstein's equation, E equals mc squared, where c is the velocity of light, means that the energy from the sun coming on the surface of the Earth would be a trillion times greater.
Okay, that's
going to
be a little
toasty. So you've got a trillion times more light and heat coming on the surface of the Earth, you're not going to have Adam and Eve or any life form surviving. Matter of fact, the Earth would be vaporized.
Okay, that makes sense. But how does accelerating the decay rates produce so much heat? Because that's a little different phenomena there.
Well, when a radioisotope decays, it releases heat. It releases light. And so you're going to get a lot more heat being radiated. Like if you speed up the uranium decay rate by a factor of a million times, you're going to get a million times more heat being released, a million times more radiation going through your body. And that's going to be a problem.
Okay, so we see all of this decays happen. We're just, if this is the explanation, we're compressing that into such a small time window that it's going to vaporize the Earth instead of slowly reducing the heat so that it can radiate.
For example, there's a lot of potassium in your body, and potassium is a radiometric decay isotope. And so if you accelerate that by a factor of a million, all that potassium in your body is going to be decaying a million times or a billion times faster. You're not going to survive that.
Yeah, our body doesn't respond well to that.
No,
so
it
very
doesn't.
Good. Well, okay, so one last question here. We've talked about some of the different areas where the scientific evidence really does point to the Earth being much older. What do you find the single most or the most compelling pieces of evidence that the Earth is really 4.5 billion years old?
Well, the fact that we see uranium-235, 238, and thorium-232 decaying into three distinct isotopes of lead. And so we can look at the ancient materials on the Earth. We can look at the amount of lead-207, 206, 208, the amount of uranium-232, or 235, 238, and thorium-232. You're getting six independent measures of the age of that sample. The fact that you get the identical answer from all six methods tells us, indeed, And by the way, the rate to which uranium and thorium decay is fairly close to the age of the Earth, which means you're getting a very accurate measure. It explains why, with confidence, we can say the Earth is 4.5662 billion years old, give or take 0.0001 billion. I mean, that's how precise it is.
Well, that's a pretty accurate number, and thank you for your comments here today, Hugh. You know, in the church, we've had this argument about how old the Earth is, and, you know, there's biblical reasons that people give for it being old and young, and there's scientific reasons for it being old and young. But when we look at the scientific evidence, it really does seem to point a very compelling picture that the Earth really is 4.5 billion years old, and that's the way God intended to create it, and that's what He's revealed to us, both in science and in Scripture.
That does it for us this week on 2819. We hope you enjoyed this new format and you learned something about old Earth creationism. What did you learn, Sandra?
You know, I think it's fascinating to know that there are different literal interpretations, because sometimes the criticism is, to be a Christian, you have to take the Bible literally and there's only one literal definition. So to know that there are multiple literal definitions of the word day in reference to creation days, I think that's fascinating. I hope that helps people to be able to speak into this topic, especially from skeptical friends who say, clearly Genesis is not historic, you know, and it doesn't show a reflection of how creation began to exist. Mm-hmm.
And with those literal definitions, that helps us understand that we have to take the context into what definition it's going to be. So yeah, it was good stuff. I'm still kind of processing a lot of stuff Hugh talked about on biodeposits.
Yeah.
That was a bit new for me, but it's really interesting. Yeah. And I love the point that he made to Hugh in Culture Talk about God being an artist and creation being
that was
his
my favorite.
Work and taking his time. Like, that was so good.
Yeah, it made sense. It clicked for me as an artist and you as a musician. It just, I think, resonates with people like us, because we say, you know, we're going to take our time to create art. So even if we could do something quickly, just the passion and the love and care that we have for it allows us, or encourages us, to really take our time with it.
That's right. So this conversation is not just for scientists, but as you can see, a lot of people can speak into this.
For sure.
All right, well, if you enjoyed this show and you want the podcast version, we are on most major podcast services. Just search Reasons to Believe Podcast.
And don't forget, subscribe to the show. Let us know what you think of this new format focusing on one topic. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are at 2819 Show. Let us know what you think, and we will see you next week.
Bye.